Welcome to Base by Base, the papercast that brings genomics to you wherever you are. If you think about the very start of a human being, that single cell, how does it know? How does it figure out, you know, where bones go, where nerves go? It's like this incredibly complex, perfectly timed symphony. And it all relies on these essential proteins, ones we've had for ages, evolutionarily speaking. Today, we're diving deep into one of the main conductors. Beta-catenin.
That's right. Beta-catenin is absolutely central. It's kind of the brain behind the want signaling pathway.
And that pathway is critical for, for everything early on, right? Setting up the body plan in the embryo.
Exactly. Body axis, tissue regeneration later on, even controlling how much cells divide throughout life. It's indispensable.
But there's this duality. Want and beta-catenin are essential, yes, but when they go wrong later in life, that's often linked to cancer.
A very famous link, yes.
So what happens if the gene coding for this conductor, CTN and B1, is faulty right from the very beginning, from birth?
Well, clinically, that leads to a really severe neurodevelopmental syndrome. And here's the tricky part. It often looks a lot like cerebral palsy, CP.
Which makes diagnosis hard.
Extremely.
And I saw this statistic that kind of blew me away. Potentially up to 4% of all CP diagnoses might actually be caused by a single gene variant like this one in CTN and B1.
It's a startling figure, and it really highlights how underdiagnosed this specific condition likely is.
Right, which is why the study we're looking at today is so important. It's this huge international effort giving us the most detailed picture yet of this often misclassified disorder. So today we celebrate the work of the large international collaborative team led by researchers at the University Children's Hospital, University Medical Center, Jubilana, and their many colleagues across multiple institutions. They've really pushed our understanding of CTN and B1 neurodevelopmental syndrome forward.
Yeah, this paper is a significant contribution because beta-catenin, it's not just holding cells together, it's a key signal transducer. Think of it like a molecular messenger or maybe a relay switch. Oh. In the main want pathway, the canonical one, when the want signal arrives at the cell surface, beta-catenin gets stabilized. It doesn't get broken down.
And then it moves.
Then it moves, yeah.
Yeah.
It translocates right into the cell nucleus.
And what's in there?
It partners up with other proteins, transcription factors, and together they switch on specific genes. Genes that tell the cell to divide or to specialize or to develop in a certain way.
So incredibly powerful.
Absolutely. Which means the whole process has to be regulated very, very tightly.
And when that regulation breaks down because of a flaw in the CTNNB1 gene itself, that's when you get this syndrome.
Precisely. It's a rare condition. It's autosomal dominant, meaning one faulty copy is enough to cause it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost always de novo.
Meaning it's a new mutation, not inherited.
Exactly. It pops up fresh in the affected individual. The parents don't carry it.
Okay. And the big problem the study tackled was, well, the lack of clarity, right?
Yeah, the lack of a standardized picture. We knew it was rare. The estimate is maybe 2.6 to 3.2 cases per 100,000 births.
That is rare.
Very. And because it's rare, and the symptoms can vary quite a bit, it's probably missed a lot globally. Earlier studies were just too small, involved too few patients to really pin down the typical features or the range of severity.
So the mission here was pretty ambitious.
It was. Three main goals, really. First, systematically catalog all the different CTNNB1 variants they found. Second, use standardized tools to define the clinical phenotype across a large, diverse group of patients.
Get everyone on the same page, measurement-wise.
Right. And third, the really crucial part, look for connections. See if the type of genetic variant could predict how severe the symptoms would be. They wanted to see if the genetics held prognostic value for families.
You can really see that drive for rigor in how they set the study up. This wasn't just looking back at a few charts.
No, not at all.
It was a huge cross-sectional study. They managed to get 127 participants involved from 20 different countries.
Which is remarkable for such a rare condition.
And how they recruited them is interesting too, leveraging social media support groups. A really modern way to find patients with these ultra-rare diseases.
It's becoming essential for rare disease research.
And they were serious about the data quality. Not just old notes, but structured interviews and a whole battery of, 14 standardized clinical tests?
Yes, a comprehensive set. Things like the GMFCS, the Gross Motor Function Classification System to objectively score motor abilities.
Okay.
And the ABAS3 for adaptive behavior, looking at practical, conceptual, and social skills. plus specific scales for speech, feeding issues, even psychopathology. They wanted real functional data.
And that rigor didn't stop at the clinic, did it? It went right down to the lab bench.
Absolutely, because just knowing the genetic sequence change isn't always enough. You need to know what that change actually does to the protein's function inside the cell.
Right. A typo in the blueprint doesn't tell you if the building will actually fall down.
Kind of, yeah. So the team did functional testing on 43 of the variants they found. They used human neuroblastoma cells, SKNMC cells, as a model system.
And what were the key tools they used for that functional testing?
Two main assays. First, the classic dual luciferase reporter system. You probably know it is the TRPFOP flash assay.
Ah, yes, the workhorse for white signaling.
Exactly. It basically measures how strongly the white pathway is being turned on or off by the variant beta-catenin. Is it boosting the signal or reducing it?
And the second tool.
The second was the cellular thermal shift assay, CETA. It's a clever technique. You basically heat the cells up gradually and see at what temperature the protein unfolds or aggregates. It tells you about the protein stability.
So does the faulty version fall apart more easily? Or maybe stick around too long?
Precisely. It gives you clues about whether the mutant protein is even stable enough to cause trouble or if it just gets cleared away quickly.
Okay, so you've got clinical scores from dozens of kids across the globe, plus these detailed molecular results. How did they tie it all together?
That required some sophisticated statistics. They used Bayesian regression models. These are powerful for handling complex data sets and looking for those genotype-phenotype correlations, like does this specific type of mutation lead to walking later? They even used survival models to track when milestones like independent walking were achieved.
Okay, let's get into those results then. The genetics seemed to point towards one main mechanism pretty quickly.
They really did. The overwhelming majority of the variants they found, 87 out of 88 unique ones, were predicted to be loss of function, LOFEF.
Meaning the protein product is just gone or non-functional.
Usually, yeah. These are mostly frame shifts or stop gains, mutations that lead to a premature stop codon. The protein either isn't made properly or it's truncated and unstable.
So this strongly backs up the idea of haploinsufficiency.
Exactly. That term just means that having only one working copy of the CTNMB1 gene isn't enough. You need both copies producing the normal amount of beta-catenin for proper development, especially in the brain.
So it's like trying to run a factory with only half the required workers. You just can't keep up production.
That's a good analogy. But, and this is important, the functional testing revealed some critical nuances. It wasn't all simple loss of function.
Ah, okay. What else did they find?
Well, among the variants they tested functionally, 11 of them showed what's called a dominant negative effect.
Okay, how's that different from just having half the amount? Haploinsufficiency means you're short-staffed. Dominant negative sounds worse.
It often is. In the dominant negative case, the faulty protein produced by the mutated gene doesn't just fail to do its job. It actually interferes with the normal protein produced by the healthy copy of the gene.
So the bad worker doesn't just leave. They actively sabotage the good workers.
Precisely. It actively hinders the function of the remaining wild-type protein. This can potentially lead to a more severe outcome than just simple haploinsufficiency.
And there was another twist, right? Something completely opposite.
Yes. Even more surprising, they found one specific missense variant that's a single amino acid change, PG575R, that did the exact opposite. It showed a clear gain-of-function effect.
Gain-of-function. So it increased want activity.
Exactly. It made the want pathway more active than normal. Yes. So think about that spectrum. The vast majority of cases have reduced want signaling due to low F or maybe dominant negative effects. But this tiny subset actually has too much want signaling. That's a critical finding.
Wow. That genetic complexity really sets the stage for understanding the clinical picture. How severe did things look for the average participant in the study?
Overall, the phenotype is severe, yes. Mm-hmm. Neurological symptoms were almost universal. Muscle weakness, hypotonia, was seen in nearly 98.4%.
Okay.
Central hypertonia, that sort of floppy, low muscle tone, in 94.5%. And something called atypical hypereflexia, basically. Exaggerated startle responses that was present in over 88%.
And motor skills. You mentioned walking earlier.
Motor development was significantly impacted. Mm-hmm. Independent walking is a huge milestone, right? Only about half the participants, 49.5%, achieved it.
Only half.
And for those who did walk, the average age was 39 months. That's really delayed. Typically, it's around 12, 15 months.
So over 3 years old on average.
Yes. And maybe even more concerning, nearly 29% of the older participants in the study were still unable to walk independently at the time of assessment.
Wow. independent walking, maybe at 39 months, maybe not at all. That just underscores how devastating this can be for families and why getting a better prognosis is so important. Were there other common features?
Yes, quite a few. Microcephaly, a smaller than typical head size, was seen in about 70%. Eye issues, particularly strabismus or crossed eyes, were very common, over 81%.
Okay.
And there were some quite characteristic facial features, dysmorphic features. A broad nasal tip was noted in almost everyone, 96%. And a long, flat philtrum that's the groove between the nose and upper lip in about 87%. Recognizing these physical signs along with the motor delays is really key for suspecting the diagnosis earlier.
Okay, so let's really dig into the core finding now, this genotype-phenotype connection. Despite the overall severity, the study found this glimmer of hope, suggesting maybe not all mutations lead to the same outcomes. What did the data show about predicting severity?
This is probably the most critical piece of information for clinicians and families right now. It turns out that the type of variant really matters. Specifically, individuals who had missense variants.
The single amino acid changes.
Yes. And remember, there were only 4 individuals with missense variants in this whole cohort of 127.
A tiny fraction.
Tiny. But those individuals showed a significantly milder overall clinical picture compared to everyone else, compared to those with the predicted LLF variants like frame shifts or nonsense mutations.
Milder in what ways? Like, how much difference are we talking?
Quite a substantial difference, actually. For independent walking, the median age estimate for the missense group was around 27.7 months.
Okay. Much closer to typical compared to 39, 45 months for the others.
Exactly. Much earlier. They also had measurably better motor abilities based on the GMFCS scores, better skills in conceptual and social domains on the ABAS3, and fewer reported difficulties with things like feeding and communication.
So that single distinction missense versus LOFFAC that provides real prognostic insight.
It really does. It's powerful information.
And that finding has immediate implications for thinking about treatments, doesn't it? If most cases are loss of function, meaning not enough want activity,
right,
then the therapeutic strategy seems pretty straightforward, at least conceptually. Find ways to boost beta-catenin levels or activity.
That's the logical path forward, absolutely.
Yeah.
The fact that lofaploy insufficiency is the dominant mechanism really points towards strategies aimed at increasing CTNNB1 gene expression. Things like perhaps antisense oligonucleotides, ASOs, designed to boost production from the healthy allele, or maybe even gene activation technologies.
So the research focus can narrow down a bit.
It provides a clear target for a large group of patients, yes. The field can now focus more on developing and testing those kinds of boosting strategies.
But, okay, wait. If, say, 90-something percent of cases are LOFF, why did the study make such a point about those few dominant negative variants, and especially that one gain-of-function variant? If the overwhelming majority need a boost, why worry so much about the exceptions?
Ah, this is the crucial therapeutic warning sign. This is why precision medicine is absolutely essential here. Imagine you develop a fantastic therapy that successfully upregulates all beta-catenin expression.
Okay, sounds good for the LOFF majority.
Right, but what happens if you give that therapy to the person with the PG5725R gain-of-function variant?
Ooh, you'd be boosting a pathway that's already overactive. That could be bad.
Potentially disastrous, yes.
Yeah.
And what about the dominant negative variants? If you boost overall expression, you might also increase the amount of the saboteur protein.
Which could actually make things worse, counterintuitively.
It could. We don't know for sure, but it's a significant risk. You absolutely cannot apply a one-size-fits-all upregulation strategy here.
So the genetic diagnosis isn't just about confirming CTNNB1 syndrome. It's about figuring out the mechanism LOFF, dominant negative, GOF, ideally with functional testing, before you even think about treatment.
Precisely. And one more layer of complexity they noted was this recurrent variant, PY333X. It popped up in 8 different individuals.
Okay, was there an obvious reason, like a mutational hotspot?
Apparently not. No clear genomic reason for it to recur so often. But crucially, when they tested its function, it acted via that tricky dominant negative mechanism.
So even a variant that might look like a standard premature stop codon on paper could actually be one of the interfering totes.
Exactly. It reinforces the need to go beyond just the DNA sequence and understand the functional consequences, especially when developing therapies.
Right. So wrapping this up, what's the main take-home message from this incredibly detailed deep dive?
I think there are 2 key things. First, this study gives us the best, most standardized picture yet of CTNNB1 syndrome. It confirms that, yes, the main issue for most is loss of function, reduced want signaling, leading to those severe motor and cognitive problems.
Okay, the big picture confirmed.
But second, and just as important, we now have clear evidence that the type of variant, specifically missense mutations, is linked to a significantly milder outcome. This gives real prognostic power to detailed genetic and ideally functional diagnosis.
Which leads to the final question.
Exactly. It raises a really critical point for the future. As researchers push forward with therapies aimed at boosting beta-catenin, how quickly can we develop and implement affordable, accessible diagnostic tests that can reliably tell apart pure loss of function from dominant negative, from gain-of-function variants? The safety and effectiveness of future treatments really depend on getting that molecular distinction right for every single patient.
A crucial step before therapy can move forward safely.
This episode was based on an open access article under the CCB Y4.0 license. You can find a direct link to the paper and the license in our episode description. If you enjoyed this, follow or subscribe in your podcast app and leave a 5-star rating. If you'd like to support our work, use the donation link in the description. Thanks for listening, and join us next time as we explore more science, base by base.